Hi, everybody. My name is Ilana Gadish, and I am the associate editor for Kol Mevaser. Kol Mevaser is the Jewish thought magazine of the Yeshiva University student body, and we try to ennoble and enable, just kidding, we try to encourage and facilitate discussion on relevant topics of Jewish thought here at Yeshiva University and have that extend to the broader Jewish community. Tonight is our third installment of Kol Mevaser's lecture series. This semester so far, we've heard Professor Lauren Schiffman discuss the question of who is a Jew throughout Jewish history. We've heard Dr. Joshua Berman talk about learning Chumash in an ancient Near Eastern context. And tonight we will hear from Dr. Chaim Saiman, professor at professor at Villanova University. He's a scholar in Jewish law and private law theory. Professor Saiman studied in Yeshivat Har Etzion, a.k.a. Gush, and Karen Bayavne. He received his bachelor's degree at Georgia State University and law degree at Columbia University. His publications include Legal Theory, Conceptualism in Jewish Law, and Jesus' Legal Theory, a Rabbinic Reading. So this lecture is going to be recorded and uploaded on YU Torah, so if you have any friends who couldn't make it tonight or you just want an encore, you can hear it there under Kol Mevaser's lectures. So tonight the topic of the lecture is going to be the Brisker Derech. What is it? Where has it been? And where is it going? The lecture is really going to offer a unique and different perspective on the Brisker Derech, and we're very excited to hear from Professor Saiman. And I'm going to come up after and talk to you about kind of what's going to happen next semester, new issues coming up, so stay tuned and enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I never actually attended a YU institution, but having gone to Gush and Karen Bayavne, I feel like I almost have. So it's really a pleasure to be here, and really thank you to Shlomo and everybody for helping facilitate this. So I've talked about the Brisker Derech, but I've never actually had a chance to do it to a room full of people who, in one way or another, are practitioners of it. So this ought to be fun. And in that line, I think, you know, be a little more participatory than just sort of writing it down, as I assume you guys already know a good share of it. So what we're just going to try to do is to classify, maybe, you know, make a little more crisp some of the ideas that you've heard throughout your yeshiva educations. And then, so the beginning will be a sort of a little bit what the Brisker Derech has been, what is it, where it's been. And then in the last part, we'll talk a little bit about how it's developed and where it's going, particularly, you know, as there's, I think, become a distinctly modern Orthodox version of the Brisker Derech, practiced certainly in Gush. And then even from there, I think it's being pushed further by some students or students of students of those yeshivas. So let's just start sort of at the beginning. Who are the Briskers? So the Briskers refer, if we think of the first generation, obviously Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who is born in 1853, dies right around World War I, 1918. He teaches, he's a Ram or Rosh Yeshiva at Valazhin, the Yeshiva Valazhin. Valazhin closes in a rather famous sort of episode in the 1890s. He then goes to take to the town of Brisk, and sort of students follow him there. And the Brisker Derech has developed both in Valazhin and later in Brisk. Some of the other famous Briskers are a little bit younger than Reb Chaim. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, Rav Itzel Eponovitcher, Rav Shimon Shkup, Rav Yochanan Wasserman, Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, Rav Naftali Trupp, and Rav Chaim Telzer are typically thought to be the kind of first generation of students who, together with Rav Chaim, develop the Brisker Derech. Now, just a little bit about the history of the time and sort of the background of what's going on. The Brisker Derech develops in what is typically thought of to be the golden age of yeshivas, right? The age of the yeshivas, the late 19th century. Now, there's a certain irony that I assume most of you know, is that on the one hand, this is the golden age of yeshivas. This is sort of when it all develops. On the other hand, this is also the era where in that very period in Eastern Europe, right, everything is sort of falling apart. Right, if you think of Rav Chaim's lifetime, when he's born, is pre-Haskalah and pre-socialism and pre-Zionism and sort of still a very traditional community. By the time he passes away, a lot of that has changed. That sort of together with this sort of golden age of yeshivas and the learning and the whole really structure of our own approach to these things, is also the world sort of turns upside down. The yeshiva at the time is under a lot of challenges, mainly externally, by sort of two groups of people. One is the maskilim, right, who are writing articles in the journals that are developing at the time, basically criticizing the yeshiva for being primitive, for being backwards, for not accepting modernity, right, just like Ad Bichlal. Right, that's one group of people. And then ultimately they get together with the Russian authorities to come in and sort of force Volozhin to change, which is why, of course, Volozhin closed. So there's a lot of thought and stress about what the yeshiva is, what's going on there, what are they doing at the time, that is sort of coming from the outside, and is reflected, of course, inside the yeshiva as well. Scholars have argued to varying degrees that one way to think of the Brisker Derech is some sense of a response to this, that to say, no, there is something very sophisticated here, there's something very methodical, and I think that there's a lot to that. Many social movements, you will see, often adopt the values of their critics, right? And one of the ways to resist change is to adopt some of the things being changed. That is one reading of the Brisker Derech, which I think, at least in part, there's something worth thinking about. Now, the other interesting thing about the way the Brisker Derech plays out is that in the yeshivish world, in the Haredi world, it's typically associated with the sort of right-wing most faction of that world, Brisker Rav and his students. And then, of course, there's, you know, through Rav Soloveitchik, through the Rav, there's what we might call the modern Orthodox variant of it, carried out through the Rav, Rav Lichtenstein, and others, many of teach here. So that you can think of it as almost like a sort of polar element to it in the sort of Torah world, that there's the Brisker Derech is shared by communities that might be at the extremes of that world, which is an interesting feature to think about and to see how that plays out. All right, let's talk a little bit about the yeshiva, because I think the structure of the yeshiva is important to understand what happens. When we talk about the yeshiva movement, we're largely talking about a 19th century movement. Well, but of course people have been learning Torah forever, right, since Abaye and Rava. Sorry, am I not behaving? Do I need to stand here? All right. People have been learning Torah since the days, not Abaye, Rava. That's not a good idea. I will just leave that. But people have been learning Torah for a very long time, since Moshe Rabbeinu in some one way or another. So what is new about these yeshivas? Well, a couple of things. Previously, scholars say that the yeshiva is not really an institution. And the Rav of a town has a base medrash, and there's people who sort of show up there and learn, and they kind of come and go. But there's no real institution of the yeshiva. It's run by the town Rav, and there's not really financing, right? The yeshiva guys kind of show up, and they're kind of on their own. One of the things that happens in Volozhin is the yeshiva starts to take on an institution. A, it's not run by the town Rav of Volozhin. There's a Rosh Yeshiva who is separate from that, right? The students are now, and it changes over time, but to some degree or another, there's like an admission process. Right? It's probably not as much paperwork as there is today, but there's some form of like some way you have to get in. And part of the advantage of getting in is that you have some institutional support. Right, you're sort of taken care of. You don't have to run around begging for money. Part of being in the yeshiva comes with some version of a stipend. Basically, they would pay the person you lived at. There were no dorms. You'd live in someone's house who would also cook for you, usually a few people. But there's a little bit more of an institution. It's a little bit more removed from the town Rav, and a little bit more of a, it's a more elitist institution, right? It's not harder to get in. And it's a little more walled off from everyone else. And I think that this is important in understanding the development of the Brisker Derech, is that we're dealing with, you know, what we'll call Talmudic intellectuals, right, who are not engaged in psak, right, they're not really engaged in communal functions, they're just learning Torah Lishma, and of course, Reb Chaim Volozhin's ideology of Torah Lishma is sort of the constitution, if you will, of the yeshiva. Okay, so that's, I think, enough about the history. Let's sort of get into, well, what is the Brisker Derech? Of course, the Briskers were not theoreticians. They weren't, right, they didn't talk about how to do it. They sort of just did it. And it's up to later to us to kind of come and say, what can we see of what they're doing, right? It's not really, the rub is really probably the first person, the first Brisker to reflect on what it means to be a Brisker, but of course he's two generations later. So let's start with something that I assume you all know in one way or another. I'll call it the warm-up round. The famous discussion about chametz, right? So we all know there's a machlokas, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbanan, and Psachim about chametz. Do you have to burn the chametz? Or can you get rid of chametz in any way possible? Now, let's just sort of, before we get to the Brisker, what are some non-Brisker sorts of questions you would ask about this halacha of burning chametz? Come on, guys. I'm sorry? The source. How much you have to burn, the shear, the time, right, the amount, getting into when during the day, what is in the ma'akev, which bracha you make. Right, these are questions that come up in the achronim, and these are the sorts of questions that, that sort of, I would say, pre-Brisker thought tend to deal with when it comes to the burning of the chametz. Now comes Reb Chaim, and he makes a very famous chakira, and I assume you all know it or have heard it in one form or another, and he says, look, what's this machlokas really about? What are Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbanan arguing about? That the shita that holds that you have to burn the chametz says that there's an isur cheftza on the chametz, a din in the cheftza. In other words, the chametz itself is the problem, therefore it has to be burnt. Whereas the one who says you gave the Rabbanan say you get rid of it any way possible, right? That is that the gavra cannot have chametz. The person cannot own chametz, and therefore there's less of a hekpeid, right? There's less of a insistence on the method so long as you don't have it. This is a very famous one and a pretty easy one to understand. Now let's just kind of push a little bit what that means, right? And this is going to be very important for Brisker thought, is that there's a concrete mitzvah or a concrete din, right? That's what you see. That's on the ground floor. And we're saying that either behind that or above that or underneath that, maybe we'll see that matters, there's some idea, right, that the fact that you burn chametz is reflecting its true nature. Its true nature of saying that there is a isur cheftza in the chametz. Right? So that it's very, I would think of it as representational, right, that concrete Talmudic laws represent some upper level concept here understood as the cheftza of the mitzvah. Now, of course, you guys know that the Gemara does this all the time, too, right? When we talk about a Brisker innovation, it's innovation within a very traditional context, because scores of sugyas do this. My time under Rabbi Yehuda, right, who rule on some concrete thing, and then the Gemara will say, he holds a breira, right, some more abstract concept. So it's not in itself new, right, that these ideas, of course, exist in the Gemara, but the way of presenting it is new, and the truth is no one else asks, like, what is the essence of the din of chametz? Also, of course, Reb Chaim knew who we paskins like, right? But yet wanted to show how each shita had some legitimating rationale. He was not interested in choosing between the shitas. That was either already done or not yet to be done in most of the sugyas he dealt with. But he tried to say, here's a machlokas, let me give a rationale for each. Now, many of the Brisker Chakiras have, and the chart I have there on have this sort of structure, where they tend to divide the dinim into internal versus external, essential versus circumstantial, intrinsic versus extrinsic, universal versus local, legal versus factual, cheftza versus gavra. In other words, very much that each one has an essence, an essentialism. Those of you who know some philosophy, very important to the Briskers, that there's a true core of something, and then there's some external thing. And many, many of the chakiras, you can see it sort of dividing on this line between the internal and the external. All right, let's do another one. And this begins to what I would call the way that they conceive of facts in the world. And let's just take a look at this Machlokas Rambam Rivin. So this is in Hilchas Kilayim. So Kohanim Shalabshu Bigdei Kahuna Shalob Bishas Avoda. In other words, the Kohanim who wear the special Bigdei Kahuna when they're not doing avodah service, afilu ben mikdash lokim, right? Mipnei avnet shehu kilayim. So even if they're in the mikdash, right? So if you pay attention to the Mishkan parshios, you'll realize that some of the big kahuna have shatnez. Okay, so now it's the problem of what? How can you wear them, right? And are you going to be over the isur of shatnez? So it's the Rambam. Right, if you wear them, even if you're in the mikdash, shelo b'shat avoda, while you're not doing the avoda, then that's a problem, and you wind up tripping over the iser of shatnez. The Ravid hasagad Ravid, he says no. Ta'abaze sharei amru b'yuma perak balo kohen gadol b'mikdash afilu shelo b'shas avoda mutter. He says no. As long as you're in the mikdash, then you have your p'tur from the iser of shatnez, so long as you're in the mikdash wearing the big day gun. So if I ask you, what's the machlokas Rambam Ravid? Do I have to call on you guys? I teach in law school, you know, they do cold calls. Okay, well that's already using Brisker terminology, right? If we just look at the machlokas, basically, if you're wearing the shatnez, right, do you have to be doing the avoda or not, right? Is being in the mikdash enough, right? Or do you actually have to be doing the avoda? Now Reb Chaim comes, and we won't deal with why he does this, what the reasons for this, but he actually says it's not what's going on. And he says, Achei Nira, says both the Rambam and the Ravid hold that it's not actually the avoda that's the critical point. Even though when we just read the Rambam Ravid, it seems that that's what it turns on. Right. The question is whether he's considered, and this is going to be a very classic Brisker move, whether there's a din levishas b'gadim. In other words, let's go on. That Rambam so related Dav Gimel Levisha Hu Lavoda as Hu Diesha Halavisha Din Levisha Sabgadim. According to Rambam, sure, the guy's wearing the clothes. He's wearing the big Neguna. But he only has the din of wearing the big Neguna when he's doing it Pishas Avoda. And it's the din of wearing the big Neguna that matters. Whereas for the Ravid, right, it's going to be Aval Shalol Tzar Chavoda, but if you're wearing the big Neguna while not doing technical mikdash avoda, right? Ein ala shem levishas bigdei kahuna. Then, even though you're wearing the clothes, you don't have the shame of wearing the clothes. But the Ravid basically disagrees, right? And he says, "Degam shelo b'shat avoda, yesh levisha din levishas bigdei kahuna." Alright, so let's kind of analyze it. What is he saying? See, before we would have thought that basically they're wearing clothes and not wearing clothes. Big day kahuna. Comes from Chaim and says, no. You have to understand, what does it mean to wear clothes? There's wearing them factually, but that's not what's interesting. What's interesting is wearing them legally, having the din of wearing. Now this sounds a little weird, but let's put it in our own context for a second. If I put on a Jets uniform and show up at New Meadowlands Stadium and get on the field, am I a Jet, or am I some crazy fan who needs to be hauled off into the pen? So clearly, right, wearing the uniform is sort of meaningless unless you have, together with it, some authority to wear it, right? That seems to be obvious, right? You could put on a police uniform, and you could try to arrest someone, but that won't be a valid act. And this is sort of what Reb Chaim's saying, right, is that don't confuse the factual wearing of it from whether it's efficacious, right? Its effectiveness means you both have to be factual wearing it, but you also have to have some sort of authority that grants the legitimacy to the act of wearing the uniform. And that's how he understands it. But the way we explained it, what did we do? We said, look, everyone understands what wearing clothes are, and then we're going to create that the special category is the legal one. Right? For Reb Chaim, it's the other way around. He says, when you're wearing the clothes, but not b'shas avoda, you're not really wearing the clothes. Ein ala din levishas begadim. It's like you're not really wearing them. So the difference here is sort of what is the normal and what is the abnormal. We tend to think of it here, in the example I talked to the guys about before, last Monday night, there were two NFL games played. Right? But only one of them was Monday Night Football. The other one was football on Monday night. Now, what's the difference, right? One of them was the regularly scheduled game that had all the contractual relationships with the sponsors and all that. The other one was a makeup game played, right? But we understand when you say that of course football is being played on Monday night. But Monday Night Football is a kind of special thing that leads to all sorts of other consequences. And the makeup game, right in where was it? In Minnesota or no? It was in Detroit. Right? Didn't have that status. But what, like, the way Reb Chaim would have said is, like, it doesn't have the shame Monday Night Football on it. And that's sort of what's going on here. So that the legal category, the halachic category, begins to take primacy over the factual category. And we'll see Rav Baruch Ber does this in even greater, to an even greater sense. So he's there talking about, everybody knows that a mikvah, source 3, right? A mikvah has a psul maim shehut, right? In order for a mikvah to be valid, right, the water cannot be pumped or drawn. And if you read there, and we'll kind of read it, say it outside in the interest of time, we would say it's water, right? But it's not water that's kosher for a mikvah, because it has a psul maim shehut. What does Rav Baruch Ber say? To explain the matter of investigate disqualification of drawn water. Is it so disqualified? Devo chal shem mayim. Right? That it might not actually be water. Or, he says, no, right, is it that din psul dechal alayu? Is it that they're not valid? But the fact that he's willing to say that he's looking into a mikvah, he sees water, he knows it's water, but he says, devo chal shem mayim, right, it's not water, because it doesn't fit the halachic criteria of water, it's not even water, shows that he is sort of inverting the natural category or the social category for the halachic one. Right? Whereas we would say, like his second tzad, right, it's water, it's just not halachically valid water. He thinks of it in the way that, no, it might not actually be water. Now, if a fire was coming, would he not use it to put it out? Of course he would. Would he make a shahapa on it? Of course he would. All right. But the fact that he's willing to articulate himself this way, you see the sort of inversion or the primacy of the halachic legal status over what we might call the social or the sort of unreflective typical status. And you see this, and I'll read the next part in Hebrew, you have it there in English. And this is from the Hagdama of the Berachah Shmuel, written by his son-in-law, Rav Reuven Grozovsky. And he says, Haruch niyut, the kol dabar nitfas b'seichel ha-Torah, haya etzla kemamashiyut chushit. Right, so halachic categories, right, what he means by ruchniyut, were like physical objects. The Rav would later call this ontological. In other words, that there is a sort of thingness to it. Davar hazaya mudgash etzlo b'chol drachav uv'yikar b'birurei svarato b'alacha. Mitoch hachaya mevar l'mashal sheshor she'en lo b'aylim she'en lo din shor masik harei en shor. In Yisrael, right, in dachnishkein ox. In other words, so we all know, right? We all know, right, that a typically a shor hamazik, right, is chay. But if a shor is ownerless, then of course there's no bialim to be mechay of it. So it doesn't have the din shor hamazik. But in Rav Baruch Ber's terminology, it wasn't an ox, because the definition of an ox is not its social definition, but its halachic definition. Since this doesn't have the halachic definition of an ox, it's not an ox. Right? And the same sort of thing. Okay, let's take one more example. Rav Shimon Shkup asked the following. He asked about a tznai. So a kinyan al tznai. His example is, I will give you a sadeh if you marry my daughter. And he asks, how can you have a kinyan al tznai? Because he sees the kinyan as creating a chalos in the world. And his example is the following. If I dig a ditch, can I dig a ditch out tonight? So of course not. I dug the ditch. Even if I dug a ditch out tonight, you'll marry my daughter tomorrow, and you don't marry my daughter, the ditch is still there. And that's his question. How could you possibly ever have a kinyan out tonight? The kinyan creates a chalos, right? It creates a status of a kinyan, And then if the Tanai happens or not, how do I undo it? Don't want to get into his answer. He answers it. And he comes up with actually a quite sophisticated understanding. But the fact he's willing to express himself this way, that he sees the halachic status as something so physical, so the Rav would say ontological, that he would compare it to a physical act of digging, is very indicative of the way that he construed the halachic category. There's a famous joke that I'm sure you've all heard, right, that the brisker and his kid are having tea on Shabbos, and the kid spills it, and he says, "Aye, Tati, it burns," and the brisker slaps him. He says, "Cliche, nihin mevasha." Now, right, the reason the joke is funny is because it's sort of pulling on the same thing, right? If you hold that it's mutter to make tea, you must hold cliche, nihin mevasha. Let's claim, "I'm gonna burn." So these inversions between the social and the halachic are very typical of this layer of brisker thought, which the Rav, as I said, would call ontological. The Rav thought that this was a very important part of Brisk, and in the interest of time, I won't read what he wrote, but you can see there that he thought that was one of its prime innovations, that it took things out of the factual and made them into legal halachic categories. Let's talk about some of the characteristics that we've seen. So the first thing that jumps out at everybody is the chakira, right? The positing, and it develops over time, but just up front saying, right, there are two ways to understand this din, or this din has two subcategories, right? The division of things that were thought to be a unitary, undifferentiated whole into subcategories. Investigations into the essence of the mitzvah, right? This are chametz. What is the essence of burning chametz? What is the essence of the psul mayim she'uvin? What is the essence of a t'nai? Right, those are sorts of questions that people before the briskers didn't really ask. Also, the fact that they wanted to explain each tzad of the chakira, or each tzad in a machlokas in terms of it. They weren't interested in choosing between them. They were interested in providing a basis for each side. Now, they're not very interested in relating to that. They're not very interested in halacha l'maisa. Halachic things happen in real space, right? This we saw in Reb Shimon, that it takes on this existence that can be analogized, and the question is where the line between metaphor and sort of perception, how those work, but they happen in real time and in real space. Essentialism, right? Those of you who know some philosophy, the idea that each thing has an inner core that can be identified, and that often the job of the brisker is to attempt to identify this inner core. All right, and then some of the things that come out of that, right, we have a moving from an on-the-daf, right, go back to our football metaphors, from a play-by-play commentary to a more conceptual, right? It's not like the Rishonim, or even some of the Achronim, like the Pnei Yeshua or the Marsha, right, who are kind of giving you the running commentary of the Gemara, but they start writing on sugya, right? Be'inyan, chatzi haben chatzi ben harum, right? Be'inyan, himlei ben rabim. That's sort of the classic Achronic writing, that they're moving away from the daf. But also how they view sort of the Gemara. The Gemara now becomes not the embodiment of the halacha, but sort of evidence of what the halacha is. The halacha itself are these upper-level categories, right, which are reflected in the Gemara and the Rishonim, etc. Unlike some of the 16th to 18th century Achronim, they're not trying to collect all the shitas and make them all work. Right? They typically sort of go back to the Rishonim or even the Gemara. So there's a gap there. They're not particularly interested in people like the Marsha, the Pnei Yeshua, the Marshal. Right? These Achronim don't figure very prominently in Brisker writing. Now, if we think about advantages, and of course the special terminology, right? The Chalos Shem Din Ha'Isur. Right? I dare anyone to try to translate. I did try. It took me forever. Right, the onset of the beginning of the status of the essence of the thing. Right? So, but what they're trying to get to without using philosophical terminology are things very close to what the Rav would call a priori, essential, ontological. All right, so what are the advantages? I think the first one, for Brisk gets a lot of criticism, justified or not, but I think we have to start with, it makes sense of a lot of things. Right, there's many, many sugyas that are screaming out for some brisker analysis. Why do they care about? What we see is just details upon details upon details of halachic minutiae. What is going on? My favorite example, right? the Mishnah, if people think that this is late Bavli, right? The Mishnah in Nazir, says there's a guy walking down the street, and he says he sees a koi, which is a suffix chaya, suffix behema. And he says, Hareini Nazir Mzub chaya. And the other guy says, Hareini Nazir Mzub behema. Vashlishi Omer, Hareini Nazir Marisha Nazir. Vareini Omer, Hareini Nazir Mashemi Nazir. Vachamisha Hareini Nazir Mshnei Nazir. Vashlishi Omer, Hareini Nazir Mshnei Nazir. Now look, here's what I can tell you. I'm not a scholar of the second century, but I promise you, and it goes up to 10 in the Mishnah, that there's not bands of roving 10 guys roving around second century Palestine, right, looking at this koi, which is a Safakai Safahema playing the zero scale. But clearly that Mishnah is begging for some concept of what, how do we understand a Safak, understand a zero, and what the Briskers do, and do very well, is provide that language. They deal with the Gemara and the Rishonim at the level of details that they do, right? Very different than the Tami HaMitzvah literature, which says, let me tell you what's going on in this mitzvah. Right? So this is like the Rambam, the Chinuch, right? And what do? They pick like two or three halachas, they explain them, and then they just don't deal with all the rest of it. But the advantage of the Brisker is that they deal with it at the level at which it's discussed, which I think is something we really have to hone in on. They give meaning to the halachic midrash. In other words, this is about something. And we'll talk about what we mean by something. It's also a way to all sorts of areas of halacha that are not practiced, right? Zvachim, right? Now doing not yomi zvachim, so the Brisker said we're into that. Taharos, right? And even some of the concepts in the Bavlis that we don't really use, they're able to abstract them so that they can become part of our lived experience, even though we don't actually practice these halacha. All right. So now let's go to what I would call the sort of second part, which is sort of an evaluation and a way of thinking of where are we. The first thing is, here's what Brisker Chakira typically don't do. They're not theological. In other words, you don't ask why we burn chametz, right? They ask, right, sort of what is the meaning of this shita that says burn chametz this way or another way? But the kind of philosophical or theological question of why burn chametz, why can't I have chametz, that is not part of the Brisker agenda. It's not philosophical. In other words, if we go back to our mikveh requirement, how do all the details of what the mikveh are? It can't be Maim Shuvin, it has to be 40 Sah, it can't be Zochlin, if anyone learned mikvos, right? There's all sorts of different categories there. Sort of explaining the philosophical rationale is also not on the agenda. They're also not into what I would call the spiritual question. How does this make me a better Jew? Right? That's the question that the Rav said homo religiosus asks, right? That's what the Hasid asks. That's not what the Brisker asks. What does this mean to my life? Right? These are questions quite far outside the orbit. The practical or moral questions. In other words, who cares? What difference is it? And I want to come back to this. What are the stakes of this debate? Why would anyone care? Or are these just different ways of imagining concepts? Or moral. Which side of the Chakira produces better results? Which is more fair? Which is more just? Which is more consistent with our conception of ourselves? Pretty much none of these things are on the agenda, and maybe almost the Chakiras are designed so that none of these things are on the agenda. Now, as you can tell, it's exactly these things that are going to begin to shift as we sort of move away from Rav Chaim into the Rav, maybe Rav Lichtstein, Rav Moshe, and maybe where we go from there. So the first thing I want to ask is, we've been calling this, and Rav Aharon calls the Brisker Derech in English the conceptual approach. Is it conceptual? Now, I'm not a philosopher, but what are the concepts that emerge? What are the master concepts that emerge from the Brisker one? Come on, you guys are all in yeshiva. You do this all day. Is Chefsa Gavra a concept? What does it connect to? Rav Chaim did not string together all the different halachos of Chefsa or Gavra and say there's some meta-message. He's very local, right? He'll tell you this one is in the Chefsa, this one is in the Gavra. So one way to think about it is that maybe, at least at the Rav Chaim level, conceptual is the wrong word. Concepts have to travel. Concepts are meaningful, right, when they can travel, be applied to other situations, when they become a locus for comparing and analyzing things. Now, Rav Chaim does that, but he does it very internally. right? It's very much tied to the particularities of the sugya. One way to think about it is when you close the Gemara, what do you have left? Or what I call the mother test. Can you explain what you just learned to your mother? Assuming your mother is not, you know, some
Talmudic scholar. Maybe in this crowd is a bad assumption. I don't know.
Right now, in most of the Rambam Hakiras, you actually can't. It's very much tied to a particular question he has, a particular understanding of the relation between the Rambam, the Gemara, the Ravid. And once you close that up, there's not a whole lot to take with you. I want to compare this to two other 19th century modes of legal conceptualism. One goes on in America, one goes on in Germany. And what these scholars are doing, they're operating at the same time Rambam, is they're basically trying to write a code, a legal code. In Germany, it's the civil code. In America, we call them legal treaties. So that, take the example, because this is a classic one, of contracts. There were no contracts before the 19th century. Sure, there were contracts. There were things like we have in the Gemara, between shomrim, like bailments. There were contracts for the sale of land. There were contracts for how you buy an eved. There were contracts between palel and a baal habayit. There were contracts for the sale of fruit. Right? But there was no single unifying concept called a contract that explained it. What the 19th century legal scholars did is they went through all these cases and said, let me explain you what ties them together. And it was this concept of a contract. And they created that from it. They had to kind of kick out the cases that didn't work. And what they were left with is they wanted to produce a code. This is, I will tell you at the beginning what the master idea is, and then everything else flows with it. You don't really see that in Reb Chaim, right? But Jan is much more isolated, right? The Chiddush Reb Chaim Rambam is about 200 Reb Chaims. I mean, I don't know what to call them. You know, essays or, I don't know what you have, Reb Chaims, right? So 200, and they're not connected in any way. So I think one thing we want to think about is, to what degree is it conceptual, and what sort of concepts are operative there? Now, I think this contrasts with Reb Shimon Shkup. Reb Shimon Shkup is a Talmid of Reb Chaim. He's active in Telz. And some of the classic briskers didn't exactly like. They would say, Reb Shimon Darish Chaim Dekra. Of course, in the Gemara, right, the Tana, Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, and Darish Chaim Dekra. But they sort of apply that to Reb Shimon Shkup, and it wasn't a compliment. Right? It's like, you're doing it wrong. Why, what does Reb Shimon do? Well, the first thing he does is he writes the Shari Yosher. The Shari Yosher is what we would call a book. Right? Now, of course, Reb Chaim is a book in the sense that it has a cover on each side and pages in between. But again, there's no conceptual connection between one or the other. We could identify some methodological connections, but there's no... Reb Shimon has seven Sharim. Each one, for about 100 pages, starts off with a major thesis and then goes to prove it. Right? Systematically-ish. Yeshiva systematically. Right? But he's really got something much closer to what we would call a concept. And the other thing he does is he begins to use philosophical terminology. Now, he borrows it from the Rishonim who did philosophy, but he starts using terms not only internal to the Gemara, but terms that are drawn from the philosophical literature. Probably his most famous one is about Dine Mominos. And he asks, well, what is the source of Dine Mominos? Is the source of Dine Mominos halachic? Or is the source of Dine Mominos something that's more social? Right, that's his Chakira, and you see that's already sort of a much broader, more conceptual sort of idea than you find in Reb Chaim. And that's sort of the, in terms of the classical briskers, he's sort of at one edge. And again, there's some conflict there. His student, Rav Moshe Avigdor Amiel, writes something called Todot L'Cheker Halacha, the conceptualization of conceptualization. This is a true conceptual work of the way halachic categories operate. And it's not surprising that he is a student of Reb Shimon. He was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in the 30s.
So that's how we compare Reb Chaim and Reb Shimon. If we go to the Rav,
the Rav was also a critic of Reb Shimon. I couldn't hammer it down, but I remember seeing, and I'm sure some of your band would probably be able to tie this, the Rav also agreed that Reb Shimon, the Telzer Derech, was not correct. But the Rav takes it in a different way. And I think if we go back to our Mechiras Chametz, Sreifas Chametz example, the Rav would start with the Reb Chaim about the Chefs and Gafur, but then ask, well, what does that tell you about your experience on Pesach? What does it tell you about the meaning of Pesach for the person? Right? To say that the Chametz is an Isser Chefs
or an answer God. How does that channel one's understanding of not just the technical halachic experience, but this psychological, religious, emotional experience that is Pesach? This is, I think, one of the Rav's big innovations. That he understood that the halachic categories are not just things that are sort of relation between concepts, but they reflect and direct the way humans ought to and should inhabit those halachic categories. The most famous is, of course, the Shirim L'Zecher Avi Mori, which are really the only Shirim published in the Rav's lifetime, sort of under his auspices, if you will, which do this, right? And the Avelos ones are very famous. So that what the Rav is saying is that these are not just abstract concepts, although he thought he believed that, but they reflect sort of the way humans ought to behave and act. So that the Avelos is sort of telling you halachically how to go through and experience and live and deal with the warning. Right? So there becomes a much more social human dimension to this that you don't find in his predecessors. Now let's move to the current state of play. I think what we're seeing, or what I like to stress, is that the real question is, what sort of categories and concepts are you willing to use? The issue is not, should we be conceptual or not, but what counts as a concept, and how is that constructed? Let me give you two examples that I think are sort of the current dividing line between what I would call the Haredi version of Bris and the modern Orthodox version of Bris. And by modern Orthodox, I mean what goes around in Gush. And that's a normative thing. So, every year on Purim, I'm sure you see these signs that they say, we will give Matnas Amiyim, Matnas Avionim, will be delivered on Purim. And behind that is a halachic debate of whether the issue is that one has to give the Matnas Avionim on Purim, or whether the Ani has to receive it on Purim. Now, you can state this in very obvious Brisker terminology of Pe'ula Totza'ah. Right? That is it the action, or is it the outcome? I think in the sort of yeshivish world, that's sort of where it is. But it's conceptualized as being the din of Matanos Avonim and an assessment as to what is the critical component of that din. And what I think you'll see Rav Lichtenstein do, and again, he hasn't done this, so I don't want to say it's b'shem, but this is the sort of thing I heard from him in many different ways, is say, well, wait a minute. There's like a really interesting question here. When we give charity, what are we trying to do? Is it to teach the person that the money is not really yours, and that you want to part with it, and that you have obligations to the other? Or is it to solve a social problem of poverty? What a modern Orthodox, or you know, I think Rav Lichtenstein would do, is he would start there, but then connect it to, and say, don't trivialize it, just sort of, what is the nature of this din? But maybe tie it to some others, start thinking of, how should I understand my chiyuv of tzedakah? Is it only about, is it a result, alleviating poverty in the world, or is it teaching? Now, of course, when we set the chakir like that, it's actually both, right? It's actually both. And therefore, what begins to happen here is that the ontological status, right, of like it being two constructions, that you're locked into one or the other, begins to recede. And what we start seeing is a sort of continuum of values or of goals or ways of expression that sort of frame the debate. I think that this is a subtle shift. Now, this is not every one, but I think that this is possible in the Gush orbit and not really possible or not really done in the more Haredi orbit. Let me take another one. This is actually a chakir already that appears in the Gemara. The Gemara says that there's two mitzvahs kibud av v'aim. There's a din kavod and a din gira. So the din gira is lo yoshev b'mkomo, you don't sit in your father's place, right? You don't sit in the seat, and you don't contradict. The din kavod is ma'achilo, molicho, ma'asiyo, ma'achilo, ma'asiyo, molicho, right? You feed him, you give him a drink, you give him to eat, and you take him around. Now, one could look at this in a very narrow halachic sense and say, all right, there's sort of two denim here. And you can think in terms of esse and lo tase, right? You can think of a little bit of a chefse gavra, in other words, sort of is the object your action or the way the parent perceives it.
not the way this sort of idea is talked about in more traditional yeshivas. Now, this is something I heard while I was at the Gush. I don't remember where. But I think it's a brilliant insight. I said, wait a minute. What do you mean if there's two units? Because if you think about it, there's really two different types of relationships. My kids are 5 and 1. Right, to my 5-year-old, we teach her to, really, it's about Yira. Don't sit in Abba's place. Don't contradict Ima. Right, that you're educating the child who is subservient, and you're sort of modeling. But think about someone who's 50, who has parents who are 80. Machilo, Malvisho, right? You have to physically take care of them. What do I mean that there's two dinim? It means that there's two really different types of parents. The relationship between a 30-year-old father and his 5-year-old kid, I'm not 30, right, is very different than between a 50-year-old kid and an 80 or 9-year-old parent. Right, the 50-year-old kid is independent, has to be independent, has his own family, has his own life. And the question is, as the pair begins to fade, how do we deal with it? Whereas, and that's kavod, right? That's, you have to feed them, right? So the point is not telling uncle to bring Abba a drink and say, hey, see what I made. No! To bring a drink means your father is incapacitated. Who's taking care of him? So this is, again, it's drawing in much more of the sort of human, emotional, right, elements into it, and much less of, and sort of what's receding is these sort of formal categories. I want to then kind of say where I think, and that I think is sort of the debate between, where the issue is between the sort of Haredi version of Maharaj. The last couple of minutes is sort of push that into how far it goes. I will make up a Chakira. I teach a class I did cases on civil rights. So off-duty police officers. All right, so this is a police officer's off-duty. Now, different places have different rules about them. Some places say, when you're off-duty, your gun stays at the station, and you can't carry your gun, and you can't make an officer's arrest. Other places say, no, you carry your gun concealed, and if you see something, you make an officer. So an off-duty cop is a great kind of Brisker paradox, right? Because he's liminal. He's in between. So, and I'm adapting this from like a couple of different actual here. Right? So we say like this, it's very simple. What is the nature of off-duty? Is he, right, really a cop, right? Just right now, his duty is suspended. But at any point that he meets something that needs an officer's attention, chazor v'nirah, right? He comes back and aids his incident. Or we say, no, that being off-duty means that you're not in the din of being an officer.
By the way, that's a chakira by Kenyan, by Big Day Kahuna, right? I mean, all...
Now, that's a way to think of it. The question is it a useful way to think of it? Because if you look in the literature about this, here's what happens. Let me give you now an alternate chakira, what I would call a neo-chakira. And say, look, that doesn't help us answer any questions. Why have uniformed officers? So the literature is basically, it's about, there's a bunch of reasons. But it's about protecting civil rights. That if the officer is the bluntest form of the power of the state, and that therefore, if one is becoming in contact with that, we'll be on the receiving end of the power of the state, we ought to know that it's the state that's acting. It'll be very clear, it'll be very defined. And that's the reason why we want uniformed and only uniformed officers. Masha Ein Kein, we live in budget cuts. We can't pay for everything, we can't pay for overtime. Happens, there's a value, right? There's a reason why you might want to economize and say, let's deputize these other people who are officers, but not right now, and allow them to do it. These are both conceptual ways of thinking about the problem. I would say one doesn't tell you how to answer any question. It's about what is the analytic construction of the nature of off-dutiness. True, possibly, but not particularly relevant. The other one says, but this is what I'm going to do is I'm going to map out the relevant interests so that now here's what might matter. Well, what's the crime rate in a given community? What are the resources of a given community? Are you someone whose general interactions with the police are one that the police is protecting you? Or are you a member of society whose interactions with the police are ones that you took on the receiving end of the rather blunt instrument of power? Now, is this a chakira? What we've done now is totally receded this sort of idea that there are different constructions that are sort of hardwired physical space, and it becomes a matrix through which to view choices. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, he's given this year a bunch of times, right? So when he talks about, Kiddushin, right? The whole first paragraph of Kiddushin. And his big hakira is marriage about kinyan, or is marriage about something we might call love or relationship? He's not imagining sort of something like Rav Baruch Ber, like sort of the structure, right? He's sort of positing two ideals and understanding that you're never really in one or the other, but you're kind of swaying back and forth, right? And that what we're articulating is two sort of ideal interests, and of course we're always in the middle. So I think one of the questions, which is more in your hands than in mine, is sort of the next generation practitioners, how far do we go? Of course, many people are very afraid of this, because now this begins to look, all the things that the Rav didn't like, too much of the social, the psychological, the circumstantial now comes into it, right? And less of this sort of pure abstract nature of Brisker Chakiras. So when we use, let's say in law school, we also teach conceptually. I'll end with this example. So torts, right? Torts is basically nezikin, right? When I'm negligent and imposed on me. So with the first day of tort class, I tell my students, all right, there's two basic theories. Is it about compensation, making the person whole, so the guy whose car is now smashed whole, or is it about deterrence? Is it about to make sure I don't act negligently as to cause damage? Now, Reb Chaim also asked a version of this, right? He basically asks, is nezek an issur, or is it tashlum? But for Reb Chaim, the nafgamina was pachus mishav v'pruta. So if I have something that's pachus mishav v'pruta, it doesn't have a din tashlumin, although it might still be us. Where we think that there's a whole host of, policy choices. Whether you think that tort law ought to be more, nobody thinks this one 100% or this one 100%, but as we have to choose our tort regimes and have to think about how to solve problems, do we think that the deterrence part is more important? Or do we think that the compensation part is the most important? Almost every phenomenon in the world is actually, and this is where Brisker thought might kind of ironically merge with postmodernism, is actually complicated, right? No action, very few actions or practices are fully theorized. When you investigate them, you always realize that there's an agglomeration of different sorts of ideas mixed in there. And what conceptual analysis is really good at is separating them and then testing them. So a place that chakiras seem to be going, at least in the modern Orthodox world, and there are Moshe is one, but there are people, Yaakov Ganat, Yehuda Brandis, who sort of take this even further, is sort of very explicitly saying that what we ought to be doing as we enter a sugya of learning is identifying what are the issues at stake. And when we do that, they're not neutral sort of things about like the way a din is constructed, but they have real implications. Thinking about it one way or another matters, and that's important, and that the value of the chakira is to identify it. So I think that is a place where it is going to some degree. Whether it's good that it's going there, people debate about. I can tell you my opinion, but I don't think that's particularly relevant. I think what is relevant is sort of really is where you guys take it. So, se'u l'mdu. And now I guess we'll take some questions.
A couple questions. One, you...
to what extent...
you seem to say that an idea is being developed, systematically integrated, and explainable to one's mother are necessary conditions for you being conceptual.
I would say it's one way to think about it. I don't think it's necessary. But a concept, here's what I would say, a concept ought to be able to travel. Okay? Now, right, you ought to be able to use it in other situations. If a concept is so specific to one halacha and one kasha in the Rambam, it's very hard for it to travel.
Yes, I mean, I think it's the difference between creating good and useful concepts and less useful concepts. You hinted at this at the end. I'm curious how you, to what extent you think the version of...
I knew we'd get it.
To what extent do you think that the version of Brisk Time, the value-informed and a form of Lucas which focuses on policy issues, to what extent that can really be true to original and Brisk Time?
So here's what you can say. We can say
well,
that...
We should be honest if it's not prison.
Well, again, what's your definition? Is that what Rupine did? Absolutely not. Did Rupine do a little more of that? Yes. Did Rupine do a little more of that? Yes. Did Rupine do a little more of that? Yes. Did Ramosha do a lot more of that? Yes. Is Ramosha axiomatically a Brisker? I don't know. I mean, by genealogy, I guess. But Rupmeyer, his brother... Maybe by genealogy, but probably not by methodology. So I think what we're seeing is something that is moving. I don't have the tools to normatively tell you what is or isn't. I don't know. I can sort of chart it. I can tell you what I think. Whether it's authentic or not, I don't know. I mean, can you find examples of these sorts of hakiras in the Gemara? Absolutely. Does that make it a Brisker hakira? I don't know.
Just to clarify, you said that a person putting on a police officer's outfit would be like a Kohen Gadol, not a Kohen wearing his big tikkun and not when he's Mishar to face the Mikdash, but I think the better analogy would be like an army officer when he's wearing his outfit but he's off duty, or police officer off duty wearing his outfit because they actually have the potential to be a police officer
I was just trying
not
to
like
say
a regular person putting on clothes and pretending doesn't.
No, I was using an example. To say that what Rupine's trying to get at is that the uniform itself is not the term.
Right.
Right.
But it has to be like a person with...
It's better, right?
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay, one more. Yeah, no one's making policy choices about like going to Kohanim and what they do or anything. Even if it would be relevant nowadays, no one would make policy choices. So are you sort of moving away from classical case, like different case altogether? Even moving it to like a car,
we're not going to decide anymore, but any question that comes up, you want to understand what the issues are playing. Now, you're right that the classic Briskers, it's not surprising that A, they were posting, and B, it's a lot easier to do Kachin, and in some sense, we don't really know what we're talking about. As someone who occasionally struggles through Dachian and Mifafin, right? What you're talking about is so abstract. But if you think about it in Bava Metzia, I can show you lots of them, right? That Hakira, which is trying to rebel, will have to actually be more developed for him about what the nature of torque. Now, it's true that he's not administering anything like a torque system. But if we take what he's saying and sort of this is what Galata thinks about, then there's lots of decisions to be made on the basis.
Wow.
But
I'm just saying, you won't be able to choose necessarily on the basis of our own policy.
Not only your policy, but how do you understand the different moves in the Rishonim? Are the Rishonim expressing different values? Move between these points. Are they expressing different versions? It's not about our choice. We can think about it in terms of understanding the different shikas and what are they bringing to the table in terms of the.
Thank you. All right, so thank you all for coming. In the back, you can take a few back issues, peruse copies of the past semester, and obviously thank you, Dr. Professor Saman, for coming. A Juris Doctorate, it's like a doctorate.
Well, that's how your parents have to go to law school.
And our issue on Derech HaLimud should be coming out this week, and the issue on Year in Israel also in the near future. Bezrat Hashem Yitzbarach. And also submissions for next semester. Next semester we'll be having issues on Judaism and technology, leadership, and Medina Yisrael, as well as our always famous Purim edition. So stay tuned. Start thinking of ideas and articles to submit. Submissions for Judaism and technology will be due at the end of winter break. Also, we loved...
This thing's crazy. We love to hear your comments, your input, any questions, concerns. And upcoming lectures next semester, we're going to... Just stay tuned. And if you want to sponsor an issue, or you know someone who wants to put an ad in Kolben Wasser, or sponsor an entire issue, or sponsor all of our issues, that would be great. So thank you again, Professor Samen, and thank you all for coming tonight. Have a wonderful vacation. Good luck on finals.